Well, you might ask, with $700 billion proposed for the American public taxpayers to bail out the mess that Wall Street financiers, investors, and executives have gotten themselves into, these are the men, and they are really vast majority men, so let's just be straight and call them the men who got us into this mess, got Harvard Business School degrees, had perhaps pedigrees from owning class families, went to Wall Street, the young believers and the old tycoons alike, scheming the exams they pass, which get them into positions of trading power, and then essentially make up the rules, some of them even the great brass ring to grasp if you're a trader on Wall Street, an investor, a crafty investment banker, is that you invent markets. You corner them, dominate them, and then enjoy that brief window of time before a market is regulated and everyone else figures out what you're doing, and then there's real competition again. Perhaps if you wondered whether or not the American public has any kind of moral obligation to bail out those guys, you might also wonder what else might be done with 700 billion smackers. What else could be done with that money? Say it had to be spent. What might it accomplish? Well, for example, Ruth Conniff writes in the Progressive magazine that taxpayers should compare the bailout with the price tags on a few other items deemed unaffordable by the administration and by the Democrat majority Congress. For example, let's tote up just $700 billion in spending right quick. Let's spend $500 billion on total energy independence for the United States with a shift to renewables within the next 10 years. $500 billion. Still not there yet. Let's add another $100 billion on to, let's say, something that started off the Bush administration, among other things, actually, on a very bad foot, and rebuild New Orleans, Louisiana, $100 billion. And we're only up to $600 billion. Let's get up there to $700 and poke in another $100 billion to cover health care costs plus out-of-pocket medical expenses for all of America's uninsured people. $100 billion, $500 plus $100 plus $100. There you go, $700 billion. Which would you rather do? All of that? Or bail out those guys on Wall Street? I can see why calls might be running 100-1 to Congress opposing a bailout. There's a couple of other figures Ruth Conniff mentions in the Progressive. $50 billion. Free college education for everyone for $50 billion. How about a measly $35 billion out of that $700 for universal preschool? Preschool for every young child, $35 billion. Well, those were Ruth Conniff's figures. We're very glad today to be able to speak with the National Priorities Project's executive director, Joe Comerford. The National Priorities Project, we've spoken with before, that totals up the United States federal budget, figures out with which areas like healthcare, nutrition, education, and other human needs are being sectioned off in the budget to receive how much money and how it affects various different states. I'm very glad to be able to welcome Joe Comerford of the National Priorities Project. Thank you for joining us today, Joe.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
Joe, I totaled up a few figures that Ruth Conniff presented in the Progressive magazine this week. I wonder what you think of those. Do those sound approximately in the right ballpark to you?
Well, you know, everybody's math is a little bit different, but the concept sound very much like the work of the National Priorities Project, the kind of work that we hold dear, meaning that we really raise the question, what else could we buy with the money that we spend on the Iraq War, with the money we'll maybe spend on the bailout, with the money that we spend on defunct weapon systems? What else could we buy or support that would bring us true and common security for our communities? So Ruth's figures are compelling, especially the one, I think, for the New Orleans repair. That's a very compelling figure, and I've heard that before.
Joe, the figures that the National Priorities Project takes a look at for the federal budget, and this bailout, by the way, this $700 billion is over and above and separate from the federal budget, as have been so many major expenditures in the tens of billions of dollars, totaling up over hundreds of billions of dollars just on the Iraq war alone. This $700 billion that would put us, that would effectively double our national debt into deficit spending just for this year, never mind the compounding interest on that debt in years to come.
Absolutely. Actually, a comparison figure that we've been using at NPP is that the $700 billion is more than the combined spending on the Iraq war to date. That's more than the allocated combined spending on all of the years that we've spent fighting the war in Iraq. This $700 billion will be more than that. So, right, the debt that it's going to plunge us into is going to double, in fact, the U.S. debt.
Boggles the mind. I mean, astounding just to consider how we found ourselves just in the last several weeks or so contemplating, why don't we double our national debt by roughly the amount that it costs that we've already spent on the Iraq war, which has driven us into economic crisis, arguably, already. Let's double it.
And I think that the question that we have to ask as people in the communities, local communities, who will speak with our elected officials or speak at town forums or the like, we have to ask, why is it possible for our nation to find $700 billion in 1 week when they cannot find money to repair our schools, to repair our infrastructure like the bridges, to outfit homes with renewable electricity, to give people health care so that our society can grow more healthy and that thus more productive and thus safer in terms of security, if we want to look at it that way? Why is it that we have $700 billion to give to an industry, if you will, that has failed? And it's failed because of deregulation. It's failed because of, many people want to talk about the greed, talk about the way in which the processes haven't been transparent. These are all really important things to talk about. But we are, in a sense, going to reward this bad business with $700 billion. When we can't reward our teachers with better money, or firefighters, or police, we can't support those endeavors which benefit people directly in our local communities, but we can benefit a very few people who have done very bad business.
At the risk of parroting Henry Paulson, I have to say, Joe Comerford, that you also might, if you spent $700 billion on other things, or if simply the country or the Congress, because it's really not up to us unless we actually nail our congressmen to the wall.
I actually think it is up to us, in effect. I mean, I think that's what MPP is, one of the reasons we're in business, is it's to be able to give people like me and like you the information so that we can be effective people in relationship to our elected officials, so that we can have agency and ask these questions. So if you're going to do this, Congressperson X, if you're going to do this, how are you also going to make sure that my school doesn't close? How are you going to also make sure that my hospital is able to stay open to people who right now are not insured? You know, I think that we have to ask those critical questions and really demand these kind of answers back from our elected officials. And I think one of the things that happens, at least for me, is that these numbers are so vast, I don't have a way to enter them. And so we try to break them down and crunch them, if you will, into manageable bites so that I understand that my local community that needs 31 new teachers, you know, those teachers are equal to X, and I understand what my portion of this $700 billion would be, and I can go to Congressman Richie Neal, who is my U.S. congressperson, and really ask Congressman Neal why he has the ability to find money for this bailout, but doesn't have the ability to find money for our schools.
So, your organization, National Priorities Project, has been presenting these kinds of numbers for years with every given new federal budget, and breaking them down as to how they affect states as well, and even I think counties and big cities. Your latest report at your website that people can find if they want, nationalpriorities.org, is entitled The Magnitude and Meaning of the Proposed Bailout, and you detail some alternatives just for starters if people wanted to broaden our minds. If we were required to pay $700 billion for something for the same amount of money, you write, people could have health care for 4 years for 51.5 million people.
Exactly.
4 years of 180 million homes with renewable electricity, or 4 years of 2.9 million elementary school teachers, or 4 year scholarships for university students for 27 million four-year scholarships for university students. Those are just a few things to compare the value of bailing out those guys on Wall Street.
Exactly, and we do that so that understand the trade-offs involved. So whatever portion of this deal gets brokered, there will be explicit choices that our federal government has made. We are going to, the federal government will tell us, give money to X endeavor, and we are going to at the same time continue saying that we do not have money for Y endeavor, and Y endeavor might be any of the social spending that we've seen really decline since 1979, 1980, we've really seen an erosion of spending and federal money coming to local communities in the form of entitlement programs or community development block grants. Or aid to city packages, you know, those have really declined measurably. And at the same time, we've seen two trends. We've seen an increased spending in military budgets exponentially in the last years, but certainly the trend was with us far before this Bush second administration. But we've also seen trends that have really allowed us to reduce taxes for the wealthiest 1 or in some cases 10% of the people in our communities. So while we've spent more on the military, we've curtailed some revenue opportunities, and the result has been that our cities, our local communities, are not funded in the way that they deserve to be funded. And we've made these choices. So rather than thinking that the federal budget process is out of our hands, and rather thinking that we couldn't possibly understand the ramifications of the government's decisions, we say, well, okay, so here's an example of what they could have done should they have enacted legislation that would have perhaps provided universal health care, or, as Ruth was saying, provided a total transfer to renewable energies. For me, it's one of the ways. When I was working, before I came to National Priorities Project, I worked as a local grassroots organizer, and I found that NPP's numbers were the way that people could hang on to the vast numbers that they were hearing and really talk about them in ways that really brought them home to their local communities.
Joe Comerford, I'm looking at one of the many, many charts, pieces of information that are available with a few clicks on nationalpriorities.org. And you have a National Priorities Project database that anyone's welcome to use for free, a huge repository of statistics on what the federal government spent, how it's directed its money, what states have gotten what kind of funding on a whole range of different categories of the budget. I just decided while we were talking to click on one little thing, which is child poverty in the United States, just for the years 2001 to 2007, the last year. Actually, 2005 is the last year that data is available for this, at least right here.
No, it's true. We haven't gotten the new census numbers yet.
But the numbers are hovering from 2001 to 2005, right through the Iraq War and some of the froth and big money making on Wall Street too. And I want to make sure I'm understanding this correctly. The numbers are hovering around 18%. So almost 1 in 5 children in poverty. Am I reading that wrong though?
Live in the United States. No, you're not. In some cities, the numbers are 49% of our kids live in poverty. So that means that they live in families whose combined income is below the poverty line. And you and I both know that right now, as poverty is defined, it's part of the problem, right? We have to get a new way to define poverty, because poverty, our numbers for poverty, or that define poverty, are so archaic that we often have programs that serve people at 185% or above, you know, 185% above poverty, because poverty itself is such a ludicrous concept, because it's almost no money, right, in today's standards. So, no, you're not reading them incorrectly.
It's
an astounding figure. So that's, again, what we have to ask. So how can it be in the United States, where there is such vast wealth and where we seem to have endless money for ballistic missile defense or nuclear weapons in this age, you know, in the age where we understand that nuclear weapons really have no place in the modern world, how can we still have so much money for those programs, and yet how can we tolerate the barbarism of one in five of our kids living in poverty? And thus, and actually, if we were to get out of the mind frame that would be intolerable, we could look at it another way and look at the short-sightedness of raising up a generation of young people who are under-resourced, and what the ramifications will be for our nation. You know, if they are raised with chronic health issues, or they're raised without proper education, or they're raised without the possibility of really reaching their fullest potential because of poverty, you know, the kind of guarantee that those who are not raised in poverty have of being able to really explore who they are. Think about what we don't get as a nation if these vast numbers of young people are coming up in this condition. I mean, it's short-sighted.
Another way to think about it is, how much would we have to spend on, say, for example, a program for preschool for all children, universal preschool, no matter whether you can, whether your family can afford a nanny or a babysitter to take care of the other children in a household, or the younger children or the infants, when one child goes off to preschool, no matter whether you can afford to send your child to what are in many locations in the United States, perhaps most, fee-only preschools, where there's an extra expense to send your child to a private preschool. Universal preschool, to deal partly with this the situation of almost one in five children in poverty. And that's, as you point out, the technical definition of poverty. If we considered the sort of non-government, non-technical definition, it might be much higher than one in five children. But one way of looking at this, we could spend, Ruth Conniff writes, $35 billion out of that $700 billion, about one-sixth of the amount that Secretary Paulson, former executive at Goldman Sachs, who made, I think, over $40 million there. We could spend $35 billion, less than about one-sixth of that $700 he's asking for, and have universal preschool throughout the United States of America.
Can you imagine that? What that would be like? Think about the stress on families. Think about what that would mean for parents who were able to know that their kids were getting a good, safe place to grow and thrive in this era where, you know, it really takes multiple incomes to make a family go. You know, the other number that we found when we looked at $700 billion, so I live in Northampton, Massachusetts, and we have 35,000 people in Northampton, which is small compared to Boston, I know. But we found that when we looked at Northampton's share, so as it gets local, if people get on the website and they get as local as they can with these numbers, they're actually almost more moving. Because the numbers even, you know, that you and I are talking about and that Ruth writes about are important, because they're important on a macro level. But then when we look at a community like Northampton with 35,000 people, we find that Northampton's share of this $700 billion bailout will be $74.7 million. So roughly $75 million. Now this is Northampton, Massachusetts, again, 35,000 residents. And we find that with that, 9,000 kids could have Head Start places for 1 year. 9,000 children in Northampton, Massachusetts. Now, that's more than need them right now in Northampton. But that would take care of what we hear about day in and day out in Hampshire County in Massachusetts, which is that there are not enough places for any of our kids to go to school, because the places, the Head Start places, are coveted and they dry up. And then people have to put their kids in unsafe venues and or in venues that are not challenging them or really giving them the kind of platform that they need to thrive in. And this is, again, just one town's reality as a result of its share that it will have to pay. And the share we calculate a number of different ways, but it's part of it in terms of drying up federal revenue, part of it in terms of the debt that we will incur, and so on. But 9,000 kids. Another town, Greenfield, Massachusetts, out here in western Massachusetts, is thinking actually about closing a school. Greenfield's thinking about closing a school because it doesn't have enough money to keep a school open because it's had to have so many overrides because it's gotten a decreasing amount of federal and state aid over the years. And Greenfield itself would gain something like 2,000 teachers from its share of what it will spend. Now, far more than it would ever need. But again, it's looking at the magnitude of what it will actually pay and versus the little amount of money it actually would need to be able to divert, which will, well, something will be a total train wreck for this community if its class sizes have to increase, because then we know that it's like a devolution. So our communities that can't afford childcare or can't afford proper schools or can't afford affordable housing units, then there is a negative spiral that happens in our local communities that is actually, again, counterproductive to a good and healthy and secure society. And it's actually such a symbol full of the money that we're going to spend.
We could go on and on. I think, yeah, Joe Comerford.
I know.
It's the federal budget is huge. No, it's not just you. It's the figures, and you are to be thanked and appreciated. I mean it quite sincerely. And your organization. And it is a gigantic project. People can find it at nationalpriorities.org, all of this data. Just to take one more quick example, perhaps you know someone who's elderly or who will soon be elderly in a few years, all of us will, and they have some housing problems. Mm-hmm. Perhaps they can't pay their rent, perhaps the housing's not sufficient, and elder people out on the street, the situation currently, the funding, at least most recent year for which data is available, 2006, less than $1 million. Let's round it off and call it $825,000. But call it $1 million spent, no, not just in Massachusetts, in the entire United States, federal spending on housing for elderly. That is 1/7,000th. If I have it correct, 1/7,000th of the $700 billion that Secretary Paulson is asking to spend without any discretion or supervision, and it would be a little bit resented, I think, if there were caps on executive pay, if attached to any of this. But just to give sense of the enormous needs there are in the country that are real human needs in the real economy that are not part of the financial, speculative, false, frothing, bubble-popping economy that is not a real economy. It is a financial economy that, unfortunately, the real economy has become, in a very real way, quite dependent on. And let me just ask you, Joe Comerford, when you hear Secretary Paulson and other economists and congressmen talking about how the real economy depends on this frothy, bubbly, sort of ethereal financial economy too much, so much so that if we don't bail out this financial industry with $700 billion or something approaching that right quick, and I mean this week, the rest of us, the elderly, those 1 in 5 children in poverty, are all going to have it much, much, much harder. Do you believe it?
You know, I don't believe it. I think that something has to be done, because I think our nation has allowed itself to have this kind of smoke and mirrors out on a pedestal, way too high kind of economy with the mortgage securities and the loan issues. And I think that something has to be done to shore up people's mortgages at a local level. And something has to be done to back us away from this ledge. And there's a lot of great thinking out there in terms of what we should do in terms of regulation and oversight and caps, at the same time trying to enter strategically to very succinct issues within this larger $700 billion and shore them up. And so lots of good people are doing thinking about that. I think that the pouring $700 billion taxpayer dollars into the problem without some heading off possible future train wrecks is ridiculous. I think that the fact that it's come to this head in a blink of an eye cannot be rewarded by allowing, you know, or demanding quick action like this with no oversight, no ability to think long term and plan and strategize the best way forward. So I don't think I'm not an economist in the way that other people who are thinking about this are economists. But I think too much evidence points to quite the contrary, that there are lots of ways in that wouldn't be pouring $700 billion into this problem. And it's hard to imagine people in our communities will see immediate gain should we do this, because one of the things that no one's talking about is the debt and our interest on the debt and how much we will pay as a nation over the long term on this $700 billion, no matter what comes back from it. So, no, I think that nothing should be done quickly and everything should be done thoughtfully and planfully. And everything should be done with an eye to never, ever having to be here again, ever a place where we privatize gain and socialize loss, which is our country's way. And I think in that we are in a crisis of opportunity right now, that we have opportunity to really turn things around, and we have opportunity for people in local communities to get involved in this. And I actually think one of the reasons that Congress didn't vote this week and really did, some people did dig in their heels, is because there was such an uprising from local communities. I heard a lot from people on the Hill, because NPP, of course, was talking to people and participating in local and national actions all week. And I heard back from dozens and dozens of people who said, my God, you know, staffer is saying, my God, the phones are ringing off the hook. We really had no idea. This kind of reaction. We didn't know that people were feeling this much doubt in our financial institutions or this much rage at their local condition.
Joe Comerford, I just want to ask you another question about that. The Democratic Party has traditionally been the party that is a bit more open to spending on human needs than the Republican Party, spending on things like child poverty, education, rebuilding schools, housing for elderly, a bit more open than the Republican Party, just traditionally, and not to a T, not to a person, not every single congressman. There are certainly exceptions, but that's by far the general trend. And I wonder, in your experience, if what you think about seeing this this sort of tipped on its head now, though, because it is now, this week, major Democratic Party leaders, including one of our one based in Massachusetts, Barney Frank, who are leading the charge to get the bailout done, to sign off on this deal, $700 billion or however many hundred billion it's going to be, to provide this money to the financial industry. It is certainly led as the Bush-Paulson Republican Party bailout plan, but it is opposed by many Republicans in Congress. Whether that proves to be grandstanding or not, the financial industry, of course, has poured money into the pockets and into the election campaigns of both Democrats and Republicans, no mistake about it, and a lot of the groundwork was laid by the Bill Clinton administration for this, but also by the Republican Congress majority serving with the Democratic Bill Clinton administration. Both parties are in deep in this. What do you make of the Democratic Party congressmen and officials? They want this bailout for the financial industry.
I know. Well, I think it's not going to come for folks who are looking at our two-party system and the deep flaws involved in our two-party system. Something like this isn't surprising, right? You or I probably weren't surprised at that. The fact that someone like Nancy Pelosi or someone like a Barney Frank would call quickly for a bailout, because there is a way in which the Democratic Party has, over the years, I think, become more beholden to the kind of large money that we've seen capture the attention of the Republican Party. And so I think that it's something that, again, should give us a wake-up call. I think that there have been a number of times in our nation where we've had a really strong call for a third party, and a third party that would give us more opportunity to talk about issues, and a third party that would give us more opportunity to vote where we think our conscience wants us to vote, or where our own ideology would allow us to vote comfortably, and thus challenge the status quo. Right now we're in a little bit of a status quo. So I think it's not surprising. I think it's another opportunity for us to look at the flaws of our system, and I think it's another opportunity for us to engage those of us who identify with either party, with our party leaders, and again, call this question about why so quickly to a bailout, why so quickly to a reward for bad business without any regulation attached to it, without any plan, without any thinking, without any guarantees. Why throw money at it when we're not willing to throw money, if you will, at local communities? Why are we willing to continue perpetuating a lifestyle that allows very few to get very wealthy and very many to remain living in what are absolutely untenable situations? Why? And that's part of my thinking on it.
Joe Comerford, we have to wrap up, but I'll just let people know they can find out this information if they want to arm themselves and stock up on ammunition. That is the intellectual kind. If they choose to interact with their Congress people in that manner, you can visit the website of the National Priorities Project at nationalpriorities.org, where you'll find out that $700 billion is more than what is currently allocated for the U.S. war in Iraq, that amount would allow us to repair all our nation's 77,000 deteriorated bridges and still have $519 billion to spend, or it would allow us to rebuild all of our nation's 33,000 deteriorating schools and still have $664 billion to spend. You can find out more information at nationalpriorities.org. And I'll just let folks know, if they've heard enough already, or if they decide at any point they have heard enough, learned enough to take action, one thing you can do without going into the streets with a machine gun, which some people might seem ready to do, but none of our guests here today, but I'll just let people know you can call your congressional switchboard at 202-224-3121 and ask to speak with any congressman in the Congress, senator, representative. Again, that number, anyone can call throughout the United States to Washington, D.C. to speak with your congressman, your representative, your senator, the people whose bills you pay with your taxes. You pay their salaries, and whether or not you voted for them, you effectively elected them, and their job is to represent you. Maybe those calls need to run 1,000 or 10,000 to 1 instead of just 100 to 1 before the especially Democrat majority Congress presents this $700 billion bailout on terms that are really very weak to Secretary Henry Paulson for the Bush-Paulson bailout. You can express yourself whatever you think, whether you're that 100 or the one in the 100 to 1 calls running against this bailout, which is still about to happen, news reports tell us today, by calling at 202-224-3121. Don't take my word for it. Do the research yourself. Look it up. It's your money you'll have to spend in the next 10 years and probably your children's generation as well. I hope this helps people participate in our democracy. Thank you so much, Joe Comerford, for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for this good work.
Joe Comerford is Executive Director of the National Priorities Project.